It's indeed good once again to be able to come together with others who have similar hope in Jesus Christ of someday being around that great throne together with God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and the redeemed of all ages. Sometimes when I get in the pulpit on Sunday morning back home, I say, this assembly right here is the best place we can be since we can't be in heaven yet. That it is the next best thing to being in company with other Christians who share the same hope that each and every one of us do tonight. And if you do not have that hope, then you need to consider the fact that tonight should be the night that you make that decision to have the hope of eternal life, the forgiveness of your sin, to be able to know that all those things you may have committed, whatever they are, no matter how bad we sometimes think, it doesn't make any difference. They can all be forgiven and washed away by the blood of Christ. And that's the great hope that we have and the daily assurance that if we continue to serve God and faithfully and we submit ourselves to His will, we can be forgiven and someday be at home with Him. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? Generation goes, generation comes. But the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets. And hasting to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, this it is new? Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There's no remembrance of earlier things and also of later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. There is nothing new under the sun. Seems to be a summary phrase that would cover the thoughts that the wise man penned there by inspiration. And when you think about it, we ask the question, well, really, has the world changed that much? Oh, we've got new technology. There's no doubt about that. We see those changes, but has there been any basic change in mankind and in the struggles and the trials and the other things that man has to be involved in? Has anything really basically changed? And I think Solomon is trying to tell us there, no, not really. There's nothing new under the sun. Technology, oh yeah, back when I was a boy, there would be someone would come along and would say, hey, I got a magazine. My dad thought he had it hidden. And it would be a Playboy magazine and invite all the boys to look at the pictures of the women in there. Well, you don't have to go now to the books, to the magazine stand and make sure nobody's looking, you know, and maybe back there's a brown cover over it, and you try to get the cashier to let her know what you want without having to say, give me a Playboy. Well, you don't even have to get embarrassed like that anymore if you're a teenager. You can just get on your computer. And you can see anything and everything there. So, is there anything new? Technology. Same old sin. Pornography. Nothing new. And I think that illustrates the point for us that Solomon was trying to get across. There's nothing new under the sun. Though men may try to invent things that are new, and certainly technologically that's true, but basically we're the same as man as he was. By attributes, we're talking about just the characteristics of something, the qualities that something has. We're talking about attributes of the ages. What things are characteristic of the ages of man, regardless of what time period you're talking about? What things are characteristic of that? What are some of the essential features that we would find if we took a slice out of any century and carefully examined what mankind was like in that century? What would we discover? What would be some of the features of that? And by ages, we're simply talking about the different periods of man's existence on the earth. So again, to summarize our title, we're just simply wanting to look at some things that are true today, and they have always been true, no matter the age in which man has been on the earth. The first one that I want to suggest to you that started early and has never changed is that man seems determined to satisfy various lusts, various desires that we have, some of which they're not wrong in and of themselves, but man seems to have the propensity and the desire to settle them and to satisfy themselves no matter how they have to do it. Well, that's not anything new. That started in the Garden of Eden with Eve. We talked a little bit about that yesterday, but in that first few verses of chapter 7, Satan comes and tempts her. She knows what God said. She repeated what God said, and the devil just added that one word to what was said, but it changed everything for Eve and for Adam and ultimately for all of us. There were great changes that were set in motion that day. She was deceived by Satan. What again was so attractive to her? Well, it's what Satan told her. God knows, verse 5, in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Mankind wants that. Man, in some case, deserves, they desire that so badly. I want to rise above all these other earthlings around here. I want to achieve something nobody else has achieved. I want to be smarter than everybody else. Look at this golden opportunity, Satan says. If you'll just eat of this, you'll be like God. Well, that's how sin enters into a person. There's nothing mystical and magical about sin and that process. James talks about it in chapter 1 and says that sin begins with a temptation. When someone is drawn away of their own lust and they are enticed. Now, mind you, that didn't come from God. He says in verse 13, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when that lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. What a terrible baby that is to conceive, sin. It all started because there was an appeal to the lust of the flesh. Something that Eve, in this case, desires, something that we desire so much that we forget that we're not supposed to achieve the satisfaction of everything that we desire. And in fact, when we satisfy them the wrong way, that's called sin. Her desire to be like God led her to sin, and there was a penalty she had to pay. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, and verse 14. Why was it that Eve was not going to be permitted to be in the place of leadership? Well, Paul talks about two different reasons there. One was the order of creation. But the other issue that he brings up is exactly what we're looking at in Genesis chapter 3. And it was not Adam, he said, who was first deceived, but the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. She failed the first time she was in a position to show leadership. She failed. A good leader would not lead those who are following him into dangerous territory. They would be warned about the danger. But Eve didn't warn Adam about the danger. She enticed him to join her in that situation. So there was a penalty. She was not going to have that position. Man was. And so Paul, in those few verses there, talks about the idea of a woman and how that she is to be submissive to her husband and to mankind in general. Women are subjected. So, just to be like God, look what that cost her. And that wasn't all. Of course, we could go into chapter 3 of Genesis later on and talk about her pain in childbirth being increased and so forth and so on. But that was a costly mistake for Eve to satisfy a lust, a desire to be like God. And there are many, many more examples. There's Achan. At the Battle of Jericho, they had been instructed, they weren't supposed to bring anything back, certainly for themselves. They weren't to do that. The instructions again were plain. You know, God doesn't reveal himself in such a way that is beyond our understanding. It was clear. They were to go up, they were to take Jericho. They were given instructions exactly on how to do that. They were not to take anything that they would find for themselves, but Achan didn't listen very well. He saw some things. And finally, it all comes out. And in verse 20, Achan answered Joshua and said, "Truly, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold 50 shekels in weight, I coveted them and took them, and behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it." Achan says, "I saw that, I coveted that, and I took that." That's exactly the process of sin. He was carried away by his own lust and enticed into taking that which he had no right to take. Personal lust satisfied. Has anything changed? Not really. Sometimes a man or a woman will look out and they will see another man or a woman. "You know, my husband's not treating me very well. That man over there seems to be such a gentleman." And they will decide and get into their mind somehow or other, "I really would rather be with him than with the man I've got." And if they keep thinking along that line, Satan will help them, if he can, to tempt them in such an extent that they will go and take that man away from another woman. All because they saw, they coveted, and they will take. Things haven't changed, have they? The names are changed to protect the guilty, but that's about all. There's David. What a classic example. David yielded to temptation and sinned with Bathsheba. Here Nathan the prophet goes to him and he tries a little bit of an indirect approach to begin with. He tries to get David to see what he's done by telling him the story of the rich man and how that he didn't want to give up not a single one of his lambs, but he saw over here, here's a poor man had one lamb. And so Nathan told him about that, told him that story. And David got all worked up over that. "Why, that is terrible. Why, I'll tell you what, a guy that would do something like that, he deserves to die." Well, who was Nathan talking about? He's talking about David. That's in chapter 12, by the way, not 11. "There were two men in the city, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children." In other words, it was like part of the household. "And that rich man had a traveler coming to town, but was not willing to use one out of his own flock to prepare for him, and so he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to town. David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, surely the man who had done this deserved to die. He needs to make restitution to that poor man for that fourfold, because he has done this terrible thing, had no compassion.'" David didn't get it. And so Nathan had to say in verse 7, "You are the man. David, I'm talking about you. I'm talking about what you did. You took Uriah's wife. You lusted in your heart after her. You coveted her and you took her." Now thankfully David, living up to the name that he is described with in the Bible as a man after God's own heart, once he was confronted with it, he said, "I have sinned against the Lord," verse 13. But he lusted in his heart. Jesus said, "The man looks upon a woman to lust after in his heart, he's committed adultery with her already in his heart. He's on his way to arranging for true physical adultery if he can get it done, because he's already allowed that lust to burn in his heart, and that's where he's headed. And all he's got to find is a willing woman, and he will probably find one. Is that anything new? Is what David did really, did that stop back there somewhere and I just didn't get the memo? No, that's still going on today. He took her. He had no right to her. That was another man's wife. Well, things are about the same today, isn't it? The illegitimacy rate in our country is staggering. Now, these figures might be a little bit off depending on what year you look at, but they all seem to come back about the same. About 25% of the babies born, maybe it's higher right now, in this country are illegitimate. It's higher among some of the minority groups and others of that nature. Much higher, as a matter of fact. But what's going on here? The same old personal lust that seduced David. Exactly the same. They look out there, they see a woman, and they take her without regard to the consequences. And what it amounts to is a rejection of God's standard. Romans chapter 1, we mentioned that yesterday. The idea that there is no God, we've got to take care of ourselves. They rejected the Creator and began to worship and serve the creature more than the Creator and other than the Creator. They gave up on God. God didn't want to give up on them. They gave up on God and they left Him. And so He gave them over in verse 24 for what? In the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. That's a terrible story in Romans chapter 1. But you know what? You can pick up the paper or you can watch the news and you can see just about every one of those things going on today. Is there anything new under the sun? No, Solomon had it right when he said there isn't. Advertising appeals to the lust of the flesh. 1 John chapter 2 verse 15 beginning, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Well, what's in the world? He says all that's in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, the three avenues by which Satan tempts us, draws us away from our steadfastness to God. What's going to happen to all of this? Why don't we get this through our head? Oh yes, we're going to be drawn away, and if we are enticed and if we get involved in that, it'll be pleasurable for a while. But ultimately, there's no long-lasting pleasure in that. It doesn't even last as long as this life, usually. People find out after they do that, they're not as happy as they thought they would be. And from eternity's standpoint, they're definitely not going to be happy someday when they are condemned to eternal torment. All that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, it's not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and it's lust thereof. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. That's our goal, to do the will of God. Not be called upon by Satan and answering that call to satisfy some personal lust that we have. But I would suggest to you another thing here. That's never changed. It was true many years ago, and we see it in the Bible, and it's still true. And that is excuses for failure. Back in the Garden of Eden again. What happened back there? What did Adam do when confronted about his sin? Who did he point the finger at? Eve. He said, you know, that woman you gave me. I always sort of figured that he was pretty happy with Eve when she was created, because after all, he was alone. God saw that he was alone, and so he created woman for him, Eve in this case, for Adam. Now all of a sudden, what's he using her for? A scapegoat. Hey, don't blame me. It's that woman you gave me. It's her fault. Really? Well, what about Eve? What did Eve do when confronted once again with some explanation needed for what she did? Oh, well, that's a serpent. He deceived me. He fooled me. excuses, pointing the finger, blaming someone else. And of course, who did the serpent blame? Well, anybody he can blame. Someone said one time he didn't have a leg to stand on. He couldn't go anywhere with it. But boy, Adam and Eve sure found a scapegoat, didn't they? Well, you know, they're not the only ones doing that. In Exodus chapter 32, Aaron, the high priest, he's in need of some kind of an excuse here. He doesn't want to own up to what he had done. And so, here in Exodus chapter 32, what does he do? The people, Moses is up receiving the law. And all of a sudden then, Aaron is confronted with, according to him, the people wanting to go astray and wanting to worship idolatry. And what is he going to do about it? Well, he should have put them in line, what he should have done. He should have, but he didn't. And they bring him all of their gold, their earrings and everything, and he melts all that down. You know that story. And he told later on, he said, well, I just threw that into the fire and poof, out come this golden calf. I don't know where that thing came from. All I did was throw some gold into the fire. Aaron, what are you doing throwing gold into the fire? Where are you getting that gold? Well, you see, what's he going to do? He's confronted with his own personal responsibility. Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them? Moses didn't let Aaron off the hook. Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, make a God for us who will go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up in the land of Egypt, we do not know what happened to him. We don't know what's become of him. We need a God. Don't know what's happened to Moses. So whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. So they gave it to me. I threw it into the fire and out came this calf. Yeah, that's real believable, Aaron. Aaron blamed the people. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, King Saul, again confronted with the fact that each and every one of us has personal responsibility. He didn't want to accept it either, did he? Well, let's see, what's he do here? Well, he's supposed to be about to go to war. Samuel said, now you wait 7 days, and I'm going to come to you, and I'm going to offer a burnt offering and a peace offering. You wait 7 days. So, well, the time is drawing near. And what does Saul do? He waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal. He hadn't quite got there yet. And the people were scattering. They're getting afraid. Samuel hasn't come back. What in the world's happened to Samuel? He's not back. So what did Saul say? He said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering. And he offered the burnt offering. And it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that behold, Samuel came and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, because I saw the people were scattering from me and you didn't come within the appointed days and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal and I've not asked the favor of the Lord. This is my favorite line out of this. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. Somebody had to do something. Don't you understand? Samuel, you got to understand. Things were looking bad. Saul blamed the circumstances. It's not my fault. It got beyond my control. Did it? No. He didn't want to accept responsibility. Again, in chapter 15, we got the same character, Saul. He's in trouble again. And there were consequences from that first one. This time, they are told to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. Utterly destroy. Well, how'd he do on that? They didn't do very well. Captured Agag the king in verse 8 of the Amalekites alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But they spared Agag, the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. They went through there and made their own decision about that. They were to utterly destroy it. Saul didn't lead them in doing that, but yet he comes back and he is confronted by Samuel. And imagine, you know, he says, well, did what the Lord said. Verse 13, blessed are you of the Lord, I have carried out the command of the Lord. And again, that's that humorous scene where I can almost imagine Samuel going, what is that I hear? Is that oxen? Is that sheep? Saul blamed the people. Well, is there anything new under the sun about this part right here? No. Today, we've got help. We blame other people for what we do that's wrong. Maybe it's our parents. With the help of psychologists, modern psychology, a lot of people have accepted the notion that you are not really 100% responsible for your decisions. You will always be able to find someone else to share that responsibility with you, and more often than not, they throw it back on the parents. Well, you weren't raised right. Your parents were too strict. You weren't potty trained right. And I exaggerate there. That's what we've gotten to in this. That's why we've got a bunch of our fellow citizens. They don't want to accept responsibility, and they're not going to. No matter how much you point out to them, hey, you made that decision, you did that. The husband that goes out and cheats on his wife, when confronted about it, says, yeah, you don't know my wife. You don't realize how hard she is to get along with. If you knew how difficult our marriage was, you would understand why I did that. No, there is no justification for that. But we've all learned pretty well. Blame somebody else. It's not my fault. We may not blame our parents. We may blame society. We're seeing a lot of this right now. Seem like the fashionable thing to do now, if you get upset about a decision that's been made in the courts or some other situation you don't like, just start rioting and just start looting, destroying other people's property. Go in times of a tragedy like these hurricanes and take what doesn't belong to you. And in some cases, they are almost excused with the idea that, well, you know, they're having a rough time. They've lost everything. Well, so did the man who owns the store where you're stealing his goods. He lost everything too. But we have been conveniently taught it's not my fault. We may think we don't have personal accountability, but we do. The Jews had that proverb back there that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are on edge. Back there in Exodus, Ezekiel 18. And God says, I don't want to hear that anymore. I'm tired of hearing that. It's not true. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither the father the iniquity of the son. We are each responsible and accountable human being. Don't blame anybody else. You make a bad decision, that's your fault. And Paul told the Corinthians that we're all going to give account someday of the deeds that we have done in the body, whether good or bad. And I'm not going to be able to stand before God on the day of judgment and try to justify my shortcoming by blaming it on my parents, society, my wife, my children. God is going to look at me and I'm going to be held accountable for the decisions I have made, for the things I have done. Nothing new under the sun. We talked a little bit about this yesterday. The love of material things. That's been going on a long time. We talked about Lot. The choice he made as he looked over the valley of the Jordan and he said, that's what I want, I'll take that. He wasn't looking far enough down the road. It had a disastrous result to it, as we know, the destruction of the cities, the loss of his wife who turned around and looked back, the seduction of his daughters and had sons by him, Ammon, Moab, and they were a thorn in the side of Israel throughout their history, all because he didn't make a very good decision. And is that new? Is Lot the only one that's made a terrible decision like that? No. Where it concerns riches, a lot of people make mistakes in their decision making with regard to wealth and the accumulation of it and the use of those things that they're giving the rich farmer. He looks out over everything and he's, boy, I've done pretty well here. I, that's all the way through there. I and my, he overworked those words. And he felt like, of course, the only solution was I got to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. I don't have enough space to put all that I have accumulated. Verse 19, I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. God said to him, you fool, this night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. We don't think much about that when we're young and involved in the accumulation of the things that we eventually possess. You get older, though, you begin to think about what's going to happen to that. You ever think about that? My hobby, if I have a hobby, is genealogy. But I'm not really certain that either one of my sons really care at all about what I have uncovered with regard to family history. What will happen to that information that I've spent a lot of time at when I had time accumulating? What's going to happen to that? What's going to happen to those possessions that mean a lot to me? What will happen with that? I have an old horn that, according to my dad, his dad used to in a fox hunt. I've got that up out of the way. Jane doesn't think that's a real nice decorator's item. But she lets me kind of keep it up on top of a cabinet way back in the bedroom where nobody can see it. So I saw that the other day and I thought to myself, well, what's going to happen with that when I'm gone? Who's going to care for that? Who knows? See, that rich man, he thought, boy, I've got to do something here. I've got it made. I'm going to be here a long time and I'm just going to pile all this up together. No, he said, you're a fool. Who will own what you have prepared? The foolishness of desiring to be rich and the warning that we have with regard to that. The rich young ruler. He loved his riches so much that he wouldn't do the one thing Jesus said you lack. Go and sell what you have and give to the poor. Says he went away sorrowful, for he had many possessions. He had the wrong attitude towards his possessions, his wealth. Material things. Supposedly, the story is told of two men looking down on the casket of a wealthy man. One of them said to the other, how much did he leave? The other one said, all of it. That's exactly right. No matter how much he had in the bank and in his investments, he left it all behind. I wonder what somebody did with it. Possibly squandered it. But he'd have no control over it. And so we are warned about this idea of making money, and that is our goal. Our children are sacrificed on the altar of prosperity sometime. Parents get busy accumulating things and providing things for their children, but fail to give them the most important thing that they need. God says, trust me, I'll take care of you. I'll give you everything you need. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. I remember on more than one occasion growing up, my dad and I guess maybe a little bit of bragging, but I'll do that. He lived by that verse. He was raising seven kids on a good job at Caterpillar Tractor in Central Illinois. But with the health problems he had from time to time, it was pretty rough. He lived by that. He never got worried about whether we were going to have shelter, clothing, and food. Now, my mom would kind of wring her hand, oh, I don't know how are we going to pay that? My dad would say, seek ye first the kingdom. He lived by that. He really did. That's one of the greatest things I remember about him. Well, we're all supposed to live by that. Someone says, well, wait a minute, what's your backup plan? You got to have a backup plan for Matthew 6:33. The backup plan for Matthew 6:33 is Matthew 6:33. It's the same plan. Trust me, God says, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you have everything you need. Now, not everything you want, but we'll have everything we need. And that's why we're warned about not having riches, but desiring to be rich. That's what the warning basically was to Timothy over there in 1 Timothy chapter 6. The one that who desires to be rich will fall into a temptation and snare. For the love of money is the root of all evil, not money, but the love of it. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a sorrow. And we're to learn to be content with what we have. For God says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. But this desire for wealth has been around a long time, hasn't it? There's nothing new under the sun. One other one, and the lesson will be yours. Minimum service to God. Israel of old neglected their service to God. They got consumed, as the prophet Haggai deals with in his epistle, his letter, with their own things. And they had to be straightened out on that. They were more concerned about their own homes, for example, than they were the things of God. And that's why God sent Haggai the prophet to them. They were not concerned about the fact that the project that was supposed to be underway had been neglected, because they were too busy over there trying to take care of their own houses. They wanted to make sure they were dwelling in a good house, but they weren't too concerned about God's house. And so Haggai is sent to deal with that. And I think somebody stole Haggai out of my Old Testament here. I'm turning fiercely and trying to find it, and I'm not finding it. But I know it's there somewhere. We'll go on until I find it. They were too concerned, as I said, about their own houses. And they were told, consider your ways. Consider your ways. He said, I want you to think about something here. And they're called upon to realize that they've got their priorities out of order. And they need to get them squared away. I should have marked that in here. I never had that trouble finding Haggai before. There it is. He said, you need to consider your ways. Go up to the mountains, bring wood, and rebuild the temple that I may be pleased with it and be glorified. You look for much, but behold, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why? Because of my house, which lies desolate, while each of you runs to his own house. As I said, their priorities weren't right. They were trying to offer a minimum amount of service to God, but they were neglecting him in the process of that. Because of you, the sky has withheld its dew and the earth has withheld its produce. You want to know why you're having problems? Earlier he said to them in verse 6, you have sown much but harvest little. You eat but there's not enough to be satisfied. You drink but there's not enough to become drunk. And that is to be satisfied, not drunk in the way we normally think of it. You put on clothing, but no one's warm enough. And he who earns wages to put into a purse with holes. No, he's not talking about inflation there. The reason they're not prospering like they should is they're not considering God first. They're trying to offer up to God a minimum amount of dedication and service, and it won't work. Now, they aren't the only ones that's done that. We mentioned the rich young ruler. Wasn't willing to do that final thing. One thing you lack. He wasn't willing to do it. Wouldn't do it. Peter's view of forgiveness is in this realm of minimum service. Over in Matthew chapter 18, the question is raised, well, how often do I have to forgive my brother? Well, of course, Peter learned by the time this was over, he really wasn't asking the right question. Up to 7 times? And I suppose Peter thought, well, that's pretty generous, 7 times. Jesus said, I do not say to you up to 7 times, but 70 times 7. Do you think Peter understood that to be saying, oh, 490 times, okay, but boy, that next 491st time, I don't have to forgive him? I don't think so. I think Peter got the point. You forgive your brother every time he asks for it. When he repents, Luke 17, if your brother sins against you and repents, forgive him. Forgive him. Don't try to get by on a minimum amount of forgiveness of someone who sins against you and keep track of it and say, well, that's it. I will not forgive them anymore. If they sin against me in the future, that's it. I've had it. I have done what I should have done, and that's all there is to it. No. Remember, our forgiveness is predicated upon how well we forgive others. And we get stingy with our forgiveness, and God will be stingy with his. And that'll be our fault. So today, we have Christians looking around for minimum service. Now, the fact that you're here tonight is probably a pretty clear indication you don't have a problem with this. You're here. But some are not here that probably could be here. They must be looking for minimum. Well, preacher, what do you want? I came both times yesterday. Do I have to come during a gospel meeting? That's the wrong question. That's asking the wrong question. Why would a person want to ask, do they have to do anything in service to God? You don't want to ask, do I have to do this? You want to ask, when's the next opportunity for me to do this for God? But you're familiar with the early Christians in Acts 2 and verse 42. I don't get the picture in my mind as I read that chapter that they would have even asked a question like that. Now, I'll tell you this, it could be a legitimate question. Do I have to attend all the services? A new convert might ask that because they don't know. But generally, it's people that have been Christians a long time that ask that question. Why are they asking that? Are they trying to get out of something? They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' doctrine and to fellowship and breaking bread and of prayer. They couldn't get enough. I suggest to you that they were there as the proverbial doors were opened. They were there. They wanted to be there. They wanted to learn more and more and more, and that's what we should be doing. And Hebrews 10:25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, so much the more you see the day approaching. Some people look for minimums, though. Well, I'll go Sunday morning and Sunday night, but I don't think I have to go on Wednesday night. I don't know why I have to go during a gospel meeting. That's looking for a minimum. And some people do that with giving. And again, you could ask a legitimate question as a new convert, well, what am I do? How much do I have to give? And of course, nobody's going to be able to tell you a dollar amount because, or a percentage, because the New Testament doesn't state that. But what about people who have been Christians a long time and they may still be giving the same amount they gave 10 or 15 years ago? Now, again, circumstances might be such that that's the case because it does depend upon the degree of one's prosperity. So that could change. But for someone who keeps on prospering more, shouldn't they be giving more? I would think that's what the New Testament teaches, if it's according to how you prosper. But again, some people want to try, well, what's the minimum that I can give? The Corinthians there, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, what does he say about the Macedonians there? What was the key? It looked like they were in poverty. If you just analyzed their bank accounts, you'd say, well, those people there, they're not going to be able to do anything. They can't. They just don't seem to have very much. Well, what was the key to their giving? He says, I testify according to their ability and beyond their ability. They gave of their own accord. Those churches of Macedonia? Well, how'd they do that? This not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. That's how they did it. Once you turn your life over to God, you won't have trouble surrendering your wallet. You won't have trouble giving over some of your time. Not if you give yourself to the Lord. That's the key to the whole thing. And then in verse 12, for if a readiness is present, it's acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he does not have. God doesn't expect anything of us beyond what we're able to do in any area for that matter. But he does expect us to do what we're capable of doing. And we should seek to do all that we can and not look for minimum. But you know what? There's always been people that are looking for minimum service to God. Indeed, as Solomon said, there is nothing new under the sun. Have things really changed? We've only surveyed a little bit. They haven't really changed, have they? Man still has a desire to satisfy his lust. That hasn't changed. Man still has a desire to blame his troubles on everybody else. Mankind still has a problem with materialism. And we have trouble figuring out just exactly how much we have to do for the Lord when we ought to be thinking of what more can I do because of the great debt we have to him. Have you changed your life? Have you turned your life over to God? If not, you've got that opportunity this evening to be baptized in water for the remission of sins because your faith is in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and you are willing to make that confession. Turn your life around. Turn in the direction you're going to go in God's direction. And if you've wandered away, there's no better opportunity than tonight to come back and acknowledge that and be prayed for by the saints here and know that the angels in heaven will be rejoicing. You let us know as we stand and sing together.